Being Programmed to Chill, a show about business, crime, parapolitics, and esoterica, with your host, Jimmy Fallon Gong.
Now, the funny thing is, we didn't even go through, there's still more companies.
Dude, it never, that's what I'm saying, like, this never ends. This is the never-ending rabbit hole.
So, okay, so there's, he has the Micro Moisture Controls, which is an electronics company. There's United Hotels Corporation, which sort of runs in his family, running hotels, I guess. And then that was the other thing. Yeah, you mentioned he was using, like, basically boiler rooms to, like, sell his stock. Like, boiler, that's a whole interesting thing. And, like, the mafia, different mafias, like, using boiler rooms, that's always super interesting to me. Like, basically, like, some people, like, the one episode of The Sopranos where they depict it was, like, they're smacking around the day traders because they're not pushing the right stock that they're doing a pump and dump on. But basically, he had McGrath Securities. He named it after his wife, and it was a brokerage firm. And that, and like you said, I think overseas firms as well, basically, they would do not just pump and dumps. They were probably doing that too, but like playing these weird Wall Street games with their stock of their own companies. Just really interesting stuff.
And really quick, before we move on too far from micro moisture controls, mm-hmm. a funny little story mm-hmm. about that is that supposedly his interest in that company was he wanted to develop a little bit of tech that would automatically sense rain. So when it sensed the rain, it would either be used to put up the top on your convertible or close the hotels or the windows in a hotel, because there was so much water damage done to hotels from guests leaving their windows open and then nobody knowing about it and rain getting in and messing everything up. And so it was his plan to try to perfect a little piece of technology that would prevent that and also help anybody out who's driving around a convertible in the rain.
See, that's the craziest thing too. He legitimately seems like a good business, he has a good business mind.
Yes.
And he's also a criminal. Like,
yeah, he was really riding the line there, man. Like, it was crazy. Totally like, if he decided that he was gonna go legit and like stop messing around, and that's the thing is, like, maybe he couldn't, you know, like maybe by the time that he started off in America, mm-hmm. maybe there was something behind him that wasn't going to let him get out, that he was in, and that's where he was staying.
Yeah, because, like, we know that he would basically play these games, but he, like, a lot of these were profitable, too, but then sometimes he would, like, leave them in shambles, right?
Yeah, he was, because he was trying to build such a big empire, and he kept doing that thing where he would do the merger, and then, and he would, basically, he would end up needing money, because he kept trying to build instead of stay where he was at, mm-hmm. and just, like, turn what he had already profitable. He kept wanting more and more and more. And so he eventually ended up having some problems with how big he was trying to grow it in that nefarious way.
See, to a certain extent, this does sort of undermine the theory that this is just laundering, like, golden lily Yamashita's gold money. Because, like, if that were the case, he probably would have just stuck with growing crops in Florida and then, or some other business, and then just, like, kept acquiring, like, the recycling element doesn't match.
Right. And so that's definitely a mark against it, I would say, for sure.
Let's see here. So there's one other company that I have that I think is pretty interesting. There's United Dye and Chemical Corporation, which I think was renamed Chem Oil. And I have a couple thoughts about this. I think he actually, Guterma, bought that company from Lowell Burrell, who was a different stock manipulator. And I guess you could say con man. One aspect, though, and this is speculation on my part, but, like, I do know just enough about IG Farben to get me in trouble. Because basically, every dye and chemical company in the world has a relationship to IG Farben, and specifically the dye companies, like, very tight. So, like, basically Guterma bought into a US company that probably has some relation to IG Farben. Now, the interesting thing, and I can't completely thread the needle on this, but maybe you can, or, you know, maybe it's just part of the ambiguity. But like, let me think how to say this. Basically, Guterma became one of the enemies of the RFK Justice Department. And this was at the same time that RFK's Justice Department was going after Jimmy Hoffa, Roy Cohn, and also IG Farben. So to see Guterma on the side of basically the enemies, okay, Guterma was an enemy of the RFK Justice Department, but so was IG Farben. IG Farben has a tie to this dye company. So basically, he's connected, and Guterma connected to Roy Cohn. So basically, Guterma's connected in like three ways to RFK's enemy list. I don't know completely what to make of that, but like, I'm certain that there's something going on there.
Well, and you want one more little fun tidbit to add on to that one specifically?
Yes, please.
I found something last night for the first time. I had never seen this claim before. Give me just one second. I'm trying to find the screenshot I took of it. Actually, you know what? I probably have it open still, but it's well worth it. Oh, okay. So Meyer Feldman did an oral history interview for the John F. Kennedy Library. Feldman was an important aide to JFK. He was the guy who created the Nixopedia, information on Nixon to use in the election. And so they met in 1956. Feldman was introduced to Kennedy by Ted Sorensen. And so Kennedy at the time was apparently interested in the manipulation of stock that involved a specific company, and that company was United Chemical and Dye. And so the other instigator was directly JFK. Oh, yeah. So not only RFK, but like the man himself had a grudge against United Chemical and Dye.
Oh, hells yeah. So in my most paranoid, I guess, flights of schizophrenia, one of the main theories that I think technically the LaRouchians like came up with, but like I think that like maybe separate from some of the overt Britishness, the theory is that the Kennedys, JFK, RFK together, they were basically taking down parts of the American crime networks that opposed the clique that the Kennedys were from.
Hell yeah.
Now, we're talking like three main targets, maybe four. So we're talking like IG Farben, partially due to World War II was the pretext, but also just because they were trying to trim them down and control them. We're talking Jimmy Hoffa, the Mafia, and the Roy Cohn network. Now, all of them were sort of tied together, but basically the theory is that the Kennedys were part of like sort of like the Anglo-American network of like old money Boston wealth, but not just Boston. We're also talking like New York, British capital, like that network. And then there's this other clique of basically Wild West, like mafia, unruly elements. And the Kennedys were going to war with the mafia partially to do the wishes of the class that they were from. I don't know. Like, I know this is like bird's eye view, but what are you making of that?
I mean, I don't have any sort of disagreement with that necessarily, because like I'm not like a oh no, they killed poor Jack, he was gonna save America, like I'm not like by any means up on that kind of business. Mm-hmm. But I think it's I think you got to kind of toe the line a little bit more as far as Kennedy goes, because he was making some interesting decisions as far as who he was going after and like what he was neglecting to do. And so like I think you're spot on there as far as like I guess I would compare it to like the way that the DEA, especially back in the day, like went after certain cartels and then left others alone. And so like I would argue that like historically there is an argument to be made that that's kind of like par for the course of like once you get in power, you know, I'm not going to go after all of organized crime, but the guys that aren't in my camp, they're fair targets.
Yes. Very interesting. I mean, like, there are different ways of framing it, but I think there are ways of framing it that I think most people would agree with. And then, like, what really trips me out, and this gets back a little bit to what we were talking about, where it's like, is the economy real? Like, I have seen some documents about, like, basically, like, NSA, Office of Naval Intelligence, like, infiltrating RFK Justice Department to try to, like, see what they're doing. Because, like, to a certain extent, like, and, like, why would they do that? Well, possibly because of, like, these weird capital-on-capital feuds. So it's just, like, at a certain point, it becomes an issue of national security to, like, figure out why one clique of, like, racketeers that gained the presidency is trying to take out the other clique of racketeers.
Yeah. No, I think you're totally onto something here, because, like, the one thing that, like, keeps popping into my head while I'm reading, like, different accounts of how this whole thing shook out is that, you know, the FBI and the CIA specifically were not on very good terms. At this point in time, that they're like, I'm not saying that as both of them being agents of capital, that they weren't, you know, obviously playing the same gentleman's game. But part of that gentleman's game is it does not mean that they're going to be not fucking each other over every once in a while.
Yeah, absolutely. Okay, so I've gone on my RFK like theory. Okay, let's get back to Guterma. So one last thing is just that, like, he seems to have been the only person, or maybe the first person, to head three different companies that were on the New York Stock Exchange. I am not sure if that's still true, but, like, he was the first one to ever do that, which sort of shows either that they're being run by, what was the quote, like, a fucking genius, or, like, you know, a criminal or an asset or some mixture thereof.
Yeah, I mean, I personally lean toward all three because, like, there's definitely evidence that he was all three of those things, and he was definitely not the only person at the time that was all three. And so there's precedent.
All right. So from here, I legitimately don't even know where to go.
Yeah, it's kind of hard because there's a couple of things to tie together. I would say before we 100% leave United Dye, that this is actually, that was the beginning of his troubles, for real, was that in 1956, the SEC started investigating UDY. And it took them 3 years to be able to build a case that that they could actually, like, do something with. And so it was right about that time in 1956 when he was at the, like, the peak of his of his empire, the peak of his success, that the SEC finally was like, okay, we'd have to do something about this. Like, this is getting a little ridiculous.
Which, it is interesting to me that, like, it could have been completely an accident that he might have just stepped on a landmine without realizing with United Dye. Maybe he knew, maybe he didn't, but, like, there's something interesting about the SEC action coming around United Dye, which makes me think this is some sort of IG Farben related thing, but I don't know. I can't prove it.
Yeah. And, like, so the Burl thing I think is interesting because, like, he looted UDY. Before he ended up turning over control, Burl drained, like, a bunch of money and then fled to Brazil, which, to keep in with the IG Farben thing, like, interesting choice there, buddy. and so he took off, and Guterma and, and actually this is where we get Sam Garfield in again, was Garfield was part of the UDY clique.
Wait, let me, for the listeners, like, one theory possibly would be if the United Dye Company was in fact, like, related to IG Farben, the theory, and I'm not certain, but, like, that one theory would be, like, the Germans allowed him to loot it so that he could take the money down to Brazil where all the Germans were, is one possibility at least.
Yeah, that sounds reasonable to me. It really does.
Okay. And so Guterma gets this zombie company, basically. And then how does Garfield come in?
So Garfield comes in with Roy Cohn and There's a October 1963 issue of Life magazine that does a bit of a postmortem on the whole thing. It's mainly focused on Roy Cohn, but Sam Garfield was one of the investors with Guterma in United Dye. They had gotten together previously.
No worries. I'm trying to find my old IG Farben notes. Like, I never actually did any episodes on it, but like, I read the one of the books on IG Farben, and then I took all these notes, and then I was like, I can't keep talking about industrial Germany during World War II. Man, that would be so stupid if it was there was no connection to IG Farben.
I swear I saw it, dude. Back in the day when I was digging into it, I swear I saw that like it was a subsidiary at one point of the American what was it called?
Was it General Annalena Film Company or something?
That's the one that's ringing a bell.
Prove somehow that they're related. Like, every dye company was related to IG Farben, but like some more than others.
This one, the funny thing to me is that like there's been a couple of sources that I found previously that like I swear to God they're gone. They've completely disappeared. And that's one of them, is that I know that I had like a clipping from like some old obscure book that like had no business being on the internet in the first place, that showed that there was a link, but I can't for the life of me find it again.
Well, I will say this, because I was looking up during the break here. I looked up the company, the United Dye Company, and they were in fact started by a merger with a German dye company.
Oh, there you go.
So I am 100% certain that they do have, that they did have a relationship of some kind, and I'm certain that it's related. Like, it would take longer to prove it. Like, I couldn't do it right now, but like,
but it's there. There's some sort of relationship. Okay, so what had happened was, after Burl looted United Dye, he sold it to Guterma. Guterma bought in, and he needed to find a way to get it at least manageable again as far as financials go, because like, everything was gone. Burl took everything. And so one of the things that he one of the things that had developed was that Sam Garfield and Irving Pasternak had this company called Garnack Drilling, and some of the stock went up for that. They decided to sell some of it, and Guterma stepped in and was like, yo, that's me. And so he bought some of it up, and he developed a relationship first with Irving Pasternak and then with Sam Garfield, and was like, oh, say, hey, you guys, because he was a frequent Las Vegas gambler by that point. So he had gambled at the Desert Inn before. And so he was already probably familiar with these guys.
Sorry, you're saying Guterma was already gambling with these guys?
Yeah, he had already, no, Guterma. Pasternak was actually like, he was like really close to Sam Garfield. They had a relationship that went back a little ways, and I'm pretty sure he was also close to Mo Dalitz. And so that's how he comes back up in this. But Garfield wasn't doing so hot. Pasternak he floated the idea of working with Guterma a little closer to him on his sickbed, and Garfield was like, okay, cool, or at least so the story goes. That's how it shook out. But there's, I mean, they could have crossed paths before, and this might just be a little bit of run and cover. And so they ended up trying to merge Garnack with United Dye. Mm-hmm. And one of the reasons that Garfield and Pasternak wanted to do this was that they had tried getting set up with Franklin County Coal, I believe the corporation. It was a coal business in Franklin County, at least, and that was owned by the Murchisons, funnily enough.
Now, quick question. Where is Franklin County? Where are we talking?
We're talking Indiana. Yeah.
Oh, Indiana, you say?
Yes. And so that's going to come back around later. We have another episode in Indiana as time goes on here. But that's how that one got started, was they got involved there and were trying to like balance this situation where like they needed to merge a couple of these companies, and they owed a significant amount of money to the Murchisons for this coal company, and then a pipeline in Wyoming. And so they were trying to get some fast cash.
Here's a question. The Murchisons, who are they?
So the Murchisons, I'm not an authority on these guys, but they were a rather wealthy oil family. And Clint Murchison Jr. actually was the owner of the Dallas Cowboys for a little while. And they the Murchisons pop up in a lot of the JFK stuff.
Oh, really?
They were not necessarily, yeah, they weren't necessarily friends of JFK.
Yeah, the big oil interests, such as they are,
yeah,
have interesting, I'm saying for the listener, of course, there's interesting ties to the Nazis, and then interesting ties to all the spooks that probably killed JFK, so.
You love that. And then we're kind of jumping around here a little bit, but like I have to point out that there's been a lot of claims about Garfield's relationship with Ted, or not Garfield, I'm sorry. There's been a lot of claims about Guterma's relationship with Ted Lewin, and we haven't really gotten too far into Ted Lewin, and we should at some point, but there's like basically two instances where you that this comes from, and one of them is a Walter Winchell column that as like a snide aside, he mentions that
wait Walter Winchell, that isn't that the sorry, continue what you're saying, I'm looking up something, go on sorry.
Yeah, Walter Winchell brings up when Guterma's at trial for all of these shenanigans, that like, I wonder if Trujillo knew that Garfield or that Guterma's associate, Ted Lewin, is shipping arms to Castro to use against Trujillo and us, and then goes on to say, one day the story will be told of how Guterma, Ted Lewin, the Mafia, and Ingrid Dayal are all related. And so like Ingrid Dayal was this like socialite in New York City that ended up dying in Morocco, and it was like this whole scandalous affair, but like nobody ever follows through on this. Like Walter Winchell drops it in this column this one time, and then there's like nothing about it. And so, like, I've spent a lot of time trying to, like, figure out, like, exactly, because we can speculate about where Guterma and Ted Lewin would have run into each other, but, like, there's no real concrete information. But coincidentally, there is the best avenue for this, other than, like, when they were both doing, like, gambling in the Philippines back in the day, is that in, I'm going to butcher the pronunciation, but Terre Haute, Indiana?
I think that's it.
Or you know what I'm talking about when I say it. In Terre Haute, there was this, there was a big gambling ring that got busted, like a sports betting ring for the most part. And one of the witnesses, when that went to trial, talks about how he got plugged into it via Ted Lewin in Los Angeles. And then one of the other people that testified at the trial was Irving Pasternak. And so Pasternak was a gambler in this ring, and Ted Lewin was feeding people into the ring. And so that's another possible association there between these guys, is that they were kind of running in that same circle.
Man, every like new thing we're talking about, I'm just like vibrating. Like, okay, let me pause you. Let me try to go back and digest what you're telling me. So Walter Winchell, who, for the listeners, I did talk about him in a prior episode about, it was the William Stevenson episodes.
Yeah.
Where basically Walter Winchell and Drew Pearson, they both had sort of similar shticks, because Walter Winchell was a slimy gossip columnist. I think he was at the William Randolph Hearst New York Daily Mirror. And then Drew Pearson, I think, was at... It doesn't matter. He's not. But basically, they both had like quasi, how do I put it? Like quasi intelligence networks. And they would both basically, they were basically gossip columnists, but they, you know, traded information. And then at least Drew Pearson was like legitimately like clued into intelligence. I think Walter Winchell was too. So like, okay. So Walter Winchell was the type of dude who would know some stuff. Now, what did he say again? I'm sorry.
No, it's cool. He was pointing out that that Ted Lewin actually was running guns to Castro to be used against Trujillo, and we'll get into the relationship between Guterma and Trujillo. But yeah, he points out that Ted Lewin was running guns to Castro, which I'm not 100% certain about that one. That's kind of like, that's one of those up in the air types of things. But yeah. And then he goes on to talk about that there's a relationship between organized crime, Guterma, Ted Lewin, and this, mysterious socialite that, that committed suicide, in Morocco. Or quote unquote committed suicide. She was in the middle of this like really nasty divorce thing. And then, as another aside to that, actually, I about had a stroke when Ingrid Dayal's name came up again, because I was like trying to figure out where I had read this, because like I read that first bit a long time ago, and then I came upon there was this guy named John Brody, who was a private investigator and lawyer, and he was involved in this massive wiretapping scheme in the 50s that was like, it was connected to like the weirdest shit. Like it was EG Squibb or whatever Squibb, the pharmaceutical company, and like and Dewey that was involved in like New York City Hall.
Wait, the politician?
Yeah, Truman or Dewey beats Truman or that same guy. Mm-hmm. Yeah, he was part of this weird wiretapping thing that was like getting run by this Brody guy, and then Brody like later pops up, harboring a fugitive, and the fugitive is Peter Crosby of Resorts International, and so like. And it doesn't end because like Brody ends up like he was working for Clendon and Ryan Jr. Clendon and Ryan Jr. is the grandson of Thomas Fortune Ryan, who like was one of the main financial backers of the Tommy Gun and a huge tobacco he controlled a tobacco empire, and then was one of the people that was like allowed to exploit the Belgian Congo at the behest of King Leopold. He got set up with the Rockefellers and Guggenheims to like mine diamonds that he ended Good up Lord. A lot of the diamonds that they found like weren't like jewelry quality, but they could be used for tungsten manufacturing, and so like they ended up selling a bunch to the Nazis.
Oh, hells yeah. Like this is like man, like when I like first really started getting into this, I would say arguably for me it was like getting into the William Stevenson stuff, and then I was just like,
yeah,
what? And then this is just like the same thing basically. Like
it just goes on and on and on, like it never ends. And it's like I said before, like everybody that connects to anybody in this story, it just branches out and branches out. And it's like you start to see this, you start to see the network, like how all of this ends up shaking out.
But like the thing is with this story, it's so much worse. Like yes, technically everything fractalizes forever, but like this so much more. Like these people are so networked.
Yeah. And they keep coming, like the same people keep coming up. I'm sorry, go ahead.
No, speak on that. Like the same people keep coming up, you know, for what reasons?
So like my problem with this is like I must have like undiagnosed ADD, because like I'll start going down a rabbit hole and then like I'll be fixated on like that Brody guy. And so, like, I'll keep trying to follow his life and put it in order. And then, like, he has relationships with different folks. And then, like, every time you branch off, and it always comes back. Everything always ends up coming back around. And so, like, you'll go down the Brody hole. And then, God, that doesn't sound right coming out. you start following up on Brody. And then, like, you end up getting back to people like Peter Crosby. And the Clendon and Ryan thing ends up coming back around. Like, it's just... Mm-hmm. There was an extended network of individuals that all had something to do with each other, is the way, I guess the way that I'd put it.
Yeah. Okay. So let me ask to the best of your ability to try to get back to Guttorme. Who was Ted Ewan? Yeah. In the context of the Walter Winchell quote, like, so who was Ted Ewan to Guttorme, I guess, and in general?
So... Ted Lewin, we don't really know who he was to Guttorme. Like I said, Winchell, he just kind of like drops that bomb and then walks away. Like nobody ever picks up on it again. And then there's like hints of their involvement later on, but like the links between those two aren't super concrete. But Ted Lewin is interesting in his own right. And so like a brief thing on Lewin was that he first pops up as a nightclub owner or a partial nightclub owner in Los Angeles, way back in the day, like I'm pretty sure in the 20s. And then, he ends up getting fingered for possibly being the murder of Weldon Irvin, who he was like the owner of the Morongo Lodge, which I've been able to find absolutely nothing about other than that it was like a hotspot for well-connected people in the greater Los Angeles area.
No, real quick. Do you think that the Morongo Lodge would be related to the future Morongo Casino? Because I know that like when Indian casinos got rolled out, the Morongo was one of the very first, I think.
Oh, no kidding. Yeah, I can't speak on it, but...
Yeah, I mean, I don't know. It's just the name makes me think. So I wonder if there was like... Because just for the listeners, like when the Native Americans got their casinos from the jump, that was basically funded by the mob and they had their hands in it the whole time. Not to say that they control it necessarily. They just had a hand in it, blah, blah, blah. No, it just makes me think of that. So go ahead.
Yeah. So like he ends up fleeing to the Philippines and he gets put in a camp for sure. And then that's not going so hot. And so they end up trying to take these all of these prisoners back to Japan. The ship that they're on gets sunk by the Allies. He ends up saving three of the other prisoners. He gets recaptured by the Japanese. They put him on another boat. And then that boat gets sunk by the Allies.
Can you imagine being on the boat the second time and it goes down again? No. And you're just like, what the, like a second time?
Like, come on, what are the chances?
You're already probably like starving. Like,
oh yeah, like 300 people died the first night from suffocation. They overloaded the boat, and so like it's just like it's hell on earth, and then your boat gets sunk, you get put on another, and then again, like, oh my god. And so they end up getting to Japan, and Ted Lewin, he's a crafty character, that Ted Lewin. He ends up starting like a gambling ring in the prison. And some accounts say that he fleeced the guards to the point where he was able to like get supplies smuggled in for like supporting these prisoners. And he ends up getting like a Medal of Freedom based on his wartime activities. Yeah, it's super goofy. And so like he gets out and he's running casinos in the Far East. He was called the Meyer Lansky of the Far East. He was connected to the syndicate.
So, like, at this juncture, there's a high likelihood that that Guterma met him, probably, right?
I really think so. I mean, I don't think Winchell was just, like, making shit up.
Because we don't know, but, like, he was in the syndicate, Guterma was doing crime, he was in the Philippines, expats often know each other, period. Like,
oh, yeah.
Very high likelihood, right?
I would say so, and like there's indications that that he also was affiliated with Andres Soriano, and so that would have been another link there. And so like I would say that it's honestly pretty likely that they had at least crossed paths. And I don't, you know, Winchell says in another there was one more note, and it's that he says that he reviewed Philippine security, basically their FBI, a file that says that they were associated, that they had, quote, numerous financial transactions. And so, like, there's not a whole lot of backing other than his word, but that is something that, you know, we should mention, I guess.
Yeah, I mean, people don't do crime, that type of crime, with people they don't know. Yeah.
Yeah. And so, like, just a couple more notes on Lewin, because, like, there's just a couple more things that, like, really stand out to me as being interesting. And, like, there's some folks say that, like, it was a dancer at his club that he did this favor for. And, like, that's not quite true. What the story was with the whole baby kidnapping thing.
Well, wait. Sorry. Tell the listeners what the baby kidnapping thing is before you debunk it. I mean, it's really okay. Good, but, like, what was the initial story?
So one story that I had heard was that like one of the dancers at Ted Lewin's club, I don't think it's ever specified, but it could have been the Riviera, it could have been the Key Club, it could have been he was associated with a place that was called the 88 Club in Japan, which I mean, draw your own conclusions on that one, man. Like, I'm not,
to be fair, I do think it does have different connotations in Asia. I think I've heard that. Because, like, well, I mean, I've heard this for a couple things, but, like, what's that one rapper, Rich Brian, his record label is like 88 something. I don't know. But like, I will, it is also questionable still. So go ahead.
I mainly question it on the grounds that like the dude who was involved with that with him was Al Shattuck, who was XOSS and worked closely with Willoughby and Yoshio Kodama, like smuggling heroin and like running a hit squad. Like they were they ran a huge anti-communist hit squad out in Japan, and so like it could have been any of these clubs, including the New Latin Quarter. That was the other one that was really important. But the story goes that like one of his dancers, she had a kid, and the father took him back to America, and then Ted Lewin rescued him. And that's not quite the truth. What the truth was is that it was the grandson of the vice president of the Philippines. It was that was who the grandfather was, and he tapped Ted Lewin, and Ted Lewin went out there. The kid or the dad was James R. Puckett of the United States Air Force. He worked at Payne Motors, co-owned by Lopez, who was the vice president there. And so Ted Lewin he started to like pretend to negotiate a like a financial deal for the kid. And then once he found out where the kid was, he just like went to Roswell, New Mexico himself and like got the kid and brought him back. And Mr. Lopez was very thankful that that little Puckett was returned home. And so that's just like one fun little thing.
Which like I think some people get distracted by the Roswell element, but it doesn't seem to be like Area 51, nothing related to that.
Okay. No, that's just a fun little, it was in Roswell. Like that's cool and everything, but I don't think it really has a whole lot of bearing on the whole situation. That's just my opinion though, I guess. But like a couple other Lewin notes are just that like he was suspected of another murder in Los Angeles, of a guy who was found with uranium in his car, and like the police thought that it was that it had something to do with a defrauded investor in a Mexican gold mine and uranium prospecting. And so like that's another fun one. That's when he kind of bounced back out to either Asia or. I think he went to the Philippines again first, but like by then he had been blacklisted because he had been smuggling money out of the Philippines and back into the United States and like depositing it in Union Carbide accounts, and then another one called Far East Commodities, which is like super sus.
Which like I always wondered like where something like Kiss Me Deadly or like Pulp Fiction or like what was it maybe like. Repo Man, like where did they get the idea of like a glowing briefcase? And it's just like people right. were driving around with uranium in their car. Like
yes, like that was just for real a thing that happened. And so another little note is that Elmer Perry, he's the guy who had the uranium in his car. He goes back a decent ways with Ted Lewin because they both owned a surplus converted destroyer ship called the Lux that they parked off the coast or anchored off the coast of California and turned into a gambling ship. And so like just another like fun little adventure in this guy's life. Another quick little fun one is that so he ran the New Latin Quarter, and that was like a huge draw for American acts, and it was like also where a lot of like aerospace business got done was in this section of Japan where of Tokyo where the Latin Quarter and the New Latin Quarter were located. And so he was always like taking applications for new dancers and stuff and new entertainment. And one day Howard Hughes was having a little breakfast at a diner in Texas and found that his waitress was an incredibly attractive woman and made her some big promises about being in movies one day and how he was going to hook her up with that. Well, when she finally decided to call in that favor, she was done being a waitress, apparently. The best he could do is stripping at one of Ted Lewin's clubs. And her name was, and I get these mixed up, and you'll see why in a second, but her name was either Lee Sharon or Doris Lee, but Al Shattuck, the one of the XOSS manager of that club, He was married to the other one. So it was either Doris Lee or Lee Sharon. And she, the wife, did not really fancy having this lady around because her husband did. And so she ended up getting booted. And so that the seduction of Howard Hughes ended up not really paying off for this young lady in the long run.
Okay, so several of his clubs, so some of, like, were they all in Japan or some of them, or...
So he was associated with the Riviera, and that was in Manila, and the Key Club was in Manila. But the Latin Quarter, which burnt down, and the new Latin Quarter, which replaced it, and the 88 Club were in Tokyo.
Okay, because I don't know you... Well, I know for a fact that you're a Thomas Pynchon enthusiast, right?
Yes, sir.
Okay, you've presumably read Vineland, right?
Yeah, yeah.
Okay, so I don't know about you, but when I read Vineland... You know, like, the whole, like, plot in Japan?
Yeah.
Like, when I first read that, I was just like, well, first of all, it's kind of, like, if you don't, like, I didn't know any context, so, like, the slapstick element's sort of, like, I feel like a lot of Pynchon is like this, where, like, if you don't know what he's talking about, then the zaniness kind of almost sours a little bit, but, like, I feel like... Half of what we're talking about is, like, some of this Japanese subplot in the Pynchon novel Vineland. I don't know if you agree with any of that.
I don't... I'm gonna be honest, dude. I read it a couple years ago, and I'm, like, I'm only remembering basic parts of it, and so, like, I can't speak to that too much. I apologize.
Well, I mean, neither can I, because I can only vaguely remember that part as well. But, like, I feel like... I'm going to have to reread Vineland and then think about this. And I'm currently, like, super deep into researching Japan in general. So, like, I'm going to have to go back and, like, with all of this in mind. Because, like, I know that there was, like a club. And so I'm just going to, anyway.
Yeah. I'm gonna reread that, and we should rehash this at some point. Because I'm interested in where your thoughts are going there.
Yeah, I mean, it could be nothing, but we'll see.
Yeah, it's worth checking out.
So
I think I only have one more, one and a half more things on Lewin, and I'm sorry to get so distracted on that one, but it's also ridiculous. One of the other people that he was tied to is Isaac Irving Davidson. And so, like, that's a pretty fun one for me because, like, he... David, like, check out his entry on Spartacus, whatever it's called, the Spartacus Institute or whatever.
Yeah, I love that site. Okay, a Somoza connection, Bautista connection, Marcello connection, Hoffa's, Jimmy Hoffa. Good lord.
Yeah. He's, like, in super deep, dude. Like, this guy was ridiculous. And so, like, it was reported that he was running deals, him and Lewin were working together, and I actually ended up finding, I can't remember if it was an FBI or CIA document that confirmed that they were running weapons together. And so that's just a little fun aside.
Papa Doc, George de Morenschild. My favorite thing is when you go to Spartacus and you see that the article is about six paragraphs, and then the primary sources is the entire long rest of the page.
Yes.
So he was tied to Lewin, you said. In what capacity again?
They worked together running guns, and I want to say it was, it had something to do with Israel, Nicaragua, and the Dominican Republic.
Okay, because, yeah, I'm seeing Davidson super tied in with the Caribbean network. It would make sense Lewin was. And then Lewin in doing business with Guterma, that makes the Winchell comment make sense. Yeah, I see what you're saying.
Yes. Yeah. So just a little background.
Oh, and I don't know, you probably saw this, but, like, Isaac Irving Davidson shared an office with Drew Pearson and Jack Anderson.
Isn't that something? Yeah.
For the listeners, because I know that this is, like, probably, like, hopefully this all makes sense, but, like, Drew Pearson was the other journalist that I was talking about. Drew Pearson and Walter Winchell were the two slimy, like, kind of had their own networks, like kind of doing private intelligence work, also being gossip columnists. Like, very interesting.
Yeah. And so, like, the other note about Davidson is that he was a lobbyist, and one of the people that he was a lobbyist for was actually the Murchisons. And so, to tie it back to the Murchisons again, there is an involvement there too.
Was there another Lewin fact?
Just that he was, and I know I brought it up briefly before, but that he was involved with Shattuck and Willoughby and Yoshio Kodama. Mm. And I guess aside from the fact that he was running, like, or that he was helping to run, like, an organized crime hit squad, anti-communist hit squad, one of the other things that he was doing was trafficking in drugs. And, like, they found out early on, the first thing that they tried to do was sell heroin to the Japanese in mass, and, like, that wasn't working, and so they, like, rethought their approach and were like, oh yeah, that makes sense, the Japanese wouldn't really be super inclined to be super into heroin. Crystal meth, though. Crystal meth, that has potential. And so that's what they ended up switching to make money in Japan, was they were like, oh yeah, heroin's not a huge sell, but meth, that actually is.
Which is so funny, because, like, yeah, Japan does, in fact, really love their crystal meth.
Yeah.
Okay, so I will say for the listeners, right, I think this will come out after I announce my quote-unquote season two, where I do Japan. I'm doing Japan for a bunch of reasons, but mainly because I can do Japan to set up understanding the Pacific Intelligence Network in order to eventually try to explain some of U.S. domestic politics.
Yes.
Like, I know that this sounds insane. I'm doing, like, a year-long setup to eventually get back to talking about United States politics. But basically, this episode is, like, zipping over stuff that I absolutely mean to and will get to later. So I'm so, like, jazzed.
I am super excited for the program to chill take on the Willoughby situation. I'm very excited to hear about that.
Yes. Yeah. Okay. So, let's see here. So, we're talking about Lewin because he was in business with Guterma, right?
Correct. That's how we got in it.
We know that because of FBI documents, first and foremost, right?
We don't know that from the FBI documents. We know that that Davidson and Lewin were connected from, and I think it was CIA, not FBI. But Winchell claims that he saw documents from the Philippine equivalent of the FBI saying that Guterma and Lewin were in bed.
Which seems very likely.
Which does seem likely, yes. So that's how we got onto Lewin and got so distracted.
Now, from Lewin, and where should we go now with Guterma? I think that, I guess what we haven't talked about, maybe what the SEC crackdown, does that make the most sense?
Yeah, that's kind of where we left off, and we can probably use that to transition to the Trujillo affair.
Yes, okay. Well, okay, so I have one or two things here. So before he gets in trouble with the SEC, we know for sure Guterma's running all these businesses. He's living in Greenwich, Connecticut, which is like a super wealthy place. Like, Connecticut is almost like a meme now in my head, and other people too, that like, basically if you're from Connecticut, or like you're an artist from Connecticut, like you're coming from like old insurance money, basically. So
yes. Yeah, there's a reason that like Trevor Moore mentions in his song "Time for Guillotines," burning Connecticut to the ground so that nothing can ever grow there again.
Geez, rest in peace, Trevor Moore.
No kidding, man. Oh, a real one.
Do you think they got to him?
as a super schizo paranoid, I really do. I really do. Dude, the Reagan bit. Oh my god, dude, that was the best. That's the pinnacle of comedy, in my opinion. I think about that every single day.
Oh, jeez. Okay. So, Guterma living in Connecticut, which is interesting. I guess it's fitting that he would live with all the other criminals.
Right.
It's no secret our country's in some trouble here. The left is mad, the right's enraged, and the middle's disappear. The fat cats expect us to bail out them and all their friends. And when they've spent our money, they stick out their hands again.
It's times like this that each of us need to reach across the aisle.
Instead of hurling insults, we could try to share a smile.
Put aside our differences and remember what made us great.
All the people arm in arm, and in one voice we'll say,
it's time for guillotines. It's time to raise the boards. It's time to sharpen blades. We just can't take this anymore.
I'm sorry, Mr. President, we need to have your head. And senators and congressmen, we need all of you dead.
And all the CEOs of all the banks and TV pundits too, let's show our thanks.
It really pains us, but I have to kill your wives and children too. It's purely business, we just can't have them avenging you.
We'll storm the Hamptons and Beverly Hills and the Georgetown to go home. And we'll burn Connecticut to the ground so that nothing now will grow.
It's time for guillotines, it's time to raise the boards. It's time to sharpen blades, we just can't take this anymore. Peaceful protests just were not cutting it. Martin Luther King and Gandhi both, we go suck a dick.
Yeah.